Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm very happy to be joined today by my old friend, Harvey Kronberg. I guess I should say longtime friend, Harvey, to be more flattering. Harvey's publisher of the Quorum Report, one of the most widely read sources of news and political commentary on state politics in Texas. Harvey, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jim.
So, Harvey, you're a very up-close and personal observer of politics and the process and the state and have been for a while. I wanted us to start today, if we could, by talking about some of the marquee statewide races and how they look now from your perspective, but I also want to save some time to get your reflections on the big picture in the state. We've been talking about these things for a long time and frankly haven't really, it seems like, checked in on those kinds of the path of things kinds of discussions. So I want to get to that. But let's start at the top of the ticket with the marquee race in Texas, so the governor's race. You know, at the primary level, I'm curious, is this race shaped up the way you thought it would?
I'm surprised. It depends on whose polling you believe. There's two polls that came out simultaneously last week. One was the Dallas Morning News poll, which was, I think, 1,000 registered voters. And the other, which I have actually more confidence in, is the University of Houston Hobby Institute poll, which broke 1,400 voters into registered voters and voters who intended to vote, or another way of saying that is likely voters. And likely voters are far more important. The Governor Abbott, seems to have consolidated by both polls, frankly, an insurmountable position. There's anecdotal evidence that suggests that there's some cracks in the edifice, for instance, being booed at the Trump rally over the weekend and having to essentially somewhat embarrassingly be reduced to simply yelling over and over again, elect Trump, elect Trump, elect Trump, suggests that while he may have relatively good approval among most Republicans, most Republicans aren't the ones that are going to vote in the primary. And in combination with a few other things, it may well be, I'm hearing anecdotally out in West Texas, because of his newfound intense support for school vouchers, that they may rebel. And I don't know that that was factored into those polls, or they may simply skip the gubernatorial poll. But I think that there's still a substantial amount of resentment against Abbott that has not been reflected in the polls.
Well, let me push on that a little bit. How substantial? I mean, in both of those polls you cite, despite the differences, Abbott is, pretty decently above 50%. Mm-hmm. How big is that well of discontent? And is Don Huffines the best, what shall we say, the best vehicle for that discontent? I mean, I think it was hard not to notice, what's the word we want to use, the spectacle of the Trump rally in any number of ways in Texas over the weekend and the governor's sort of odd manifestation there. I mean, in a lot of ways, managing Trump has always been difficult for Abbott, right?
Right. But those voters, the people that were at that rally will be willing to bet are 95% going to turn out for the primary, simply because they're being encouraged, if for no other reason, they're being encouraged by Trump. I don't know that Abbott inspires turnout. The presumption has to be that he's going to win without a runoff. But when you see with your own eyes, those kinds of fissures, and then you start talking to activists and whatnot. There seems to be actually just anecdotally more appetite for Alan West than for Don Huffines, but Don Huffines is going to spend $20 million over the course of 2 months, and or $15 million over the course of 2 months. And we'll see if his message resonates. We'll also see what happens over the next 5 days. We're in February, a little over a month from the primary, and the grid is probably, other than the border, one of the two most significant issues. And he potentially oversold the success in preparing for this winter. And has already walked it back, saying, you know, you simply can't be certain about that everything is going to work right. So,
you know, that seems like a bit of an unforced error. I mean, in a lot of ways to me, in terms of, you know, we're going to have a piece later today at the Texas Politics Project website that Josh and I are just kind of finishing. Well, I'm doing this. He's finishing the piece, I hope. but, you know, it seems like the governor overpromised, and I think what they missed in that is that while, you know, our own polling right after the blackouts of 2021 showed that there was a mixture of, you know, wanting to blame policy, you know, policymakers, blame industry, you know, such a big, complex, massive event. There was a lot of blame to go around. But there was also a certain amount of acceptance that this might be that the February 21 storms were a kind of once in a lifetime alignment. But what it seems like, given the lingering lack of faith in what policymakers have done, which is we found several times, or at least a few times in our own polling, suggests that what the governor might have missed is that the threshold for people being critical and paying attention to the policy might have been lowered. In other words, it's not going to, you know, it's probably a safe bet that you're not going to see an alignment of factors that strike in the cataclysmic way that they did in February. On the other hand, people's sensitivity to something less than that has been heightened. So the threshold is lower, and I think that's what they seem to realize.
I don't want to get too much in the weeds on electric grid, but I'll simply say that we had a little cold snap, just a little bitty cold snap, 3 weeks ago, and the gigawatt consumption was 74 gigawatts. At the peak of the Fury, the consumption was 77 gigawatts. You can't have and we did have one failure in terms of natural gas coming out of the Permian. We haven't increased capacity. We've barely begun weatherizing, and the demands on the grid are substantially higher than they were a year ago, simply because of the explosion in manufacturing and population in the state. I'm not arguing that any of that's going to happen. I'm simply saying that if Houston were to go down, not the whole grid, but if Houston were to go down for 2 days, it would be a dramatic reminder of dereliction or of presumed dereliction. And I think that's obviously a vulnerability. The other thing, and this is anecdotal, and I don't know if you saw it in your polling or not, but it's pervasive in my world, my civilian world, not my political world, that he has still not been forgiven for the shutdowns during the beginning of the pandemic a couple of years ago. I guess it was February, March, we shut down. And that and the grid seem to be the two biggest issues that anecdotally in the world of non-political professionals or political activists that I keep encountering that suggest that there may be more vulnerability here than the polling suggests.
Yeah, I mean,
we're only talking about whether or not he goes to a runoff. I don't see, typically the number two person in a runoff has the advantage, but I don't see enough horsepower from either Alan West or Don Huffines to be able to overcome him, but it would be a huge blow to his prestige if he was forced to a runoff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably right, in that the COVID, you know, the discontent over COVID policy and the sensitivity, shall we say, or the, you know, the kind of, you know, hair trigger on the electric grid. We see that both there in our polling, but we also see what the competitive agenda and what the strategy is. You mentioned immigration and border security a couple of minutes ago. And I think we've already seen the governor, you know, the lieutenant governor, who's not, you know, really in any kind of competitive race in the primary, both going pretty heavily to that as a way of diverting attention, which is why the snap, I think, you know, if this turns out to be not much more than a snap of cold weather, it's still ill-timed. And I agree, if we have one of the major areas experience significant problem, it's going to raise the issue at a time that the governor doesn't want it to come up. I don't think it's probably too significant in the primary if it happens at kind of a localized scale that draws attention and poor coverage, but, you know, something short of a statewide disaster. But it goes in the file for the general election, you know.
And I would add there's one more thing that's kind of a bank shot on all of this, and that is the complete mess of they've made of voter registration and mail-in ballots. It was obviously designed and targeted for Democrats, us older white guys, for instance, are a big base of the Republican Party, and not me personally, but my demographic. And I have myriad stories of people requesting mail-in ballots and never hearing back. And I personally applied for a mail-in ballot online just to see what happened, and checked back in a week later, and there was no record that I had ever offered a submission. And I know dozens of people who have had to fight to get mail-in ballots. I think that adds, I don't know what the order of magnitude of the problem is, but it is definitely something that on the margins could have an impact in terms of a runoff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been pretty interesting, the unfolding of that. I mean, and it does show you the power of, I mean, you know, the power of an anecdote in terms of, you know, the much well-traveled story of the 90-some-year-old veteran, I think, in the Houston area, who has tried twice to get a mail-in ballot and can't get one because, you know, I think his initial voter registration predated, you know, Social Security numbers, you know, some such thing.
One last thing, and that is the nonsense that they were this acute paper shortage in terms of being able to print voter registration. Perhaps the most absurd thing I've ever heard out of state government, and I've been doing this for 30 years. That printing is managed by the Department of Information Resources, which outsources to Xerox, and the printing, and it is hard. The League of Women Voters requested 2,000 voter registration forms, and we're told they could have 50. Even if you're a motivated Republican and you can't find, print out a voter registration form and mail it in, but,
it's bad optics at the very least, and raises an issue. I think they don't, that, you know, at this point in the process, they don't, you know, Republican candidates don't really need this kind of noise in the lines. To my mind, and so, you know, let's go and talk a little bit about the AG race. In some ways, as much as we've unpacked this, a much more contingent situation, shall we say, for the incumbent. You know, so in those two polls that were recently released that you mentioned, you know, they were fairly close together. There was a little bit of difference, but nothing I would consider super significant. The University of Houston Baker poll had Paxton 39, George P. Bush 16, Gohmert 13, Guzman 8, and, you know, about a quarter didn't know, you know, hadn't made a choice. The Morning News UT Tyler poll had Paxton at 33, Bush at 19, Guzman at 7, and Gohmert at 8, and about a third without not having an opinion. And that makes sense given the way that, you know, the Baker Institute folks over there used a voter screen, and UT Tyler did not. So I'm not surprised that there's a slightly larger unknown in that in the morning news poll. What do you make of this? What do you make of this race at this point?
Well, first of all, let me on the voter intensity question, and I think. I guess it's the Baker Institute. For some reason, I thought it was the Hobby Public Policy Institute. But
oh, you know what? I think you're right. Thanks for that. That's right. I don't want to get that wrong and have Mark Jones, you know, he would do so very nicely, but nicely asked me to correct that. Yeah, it's U of H Hobby Institute. Thanks. Yeah.
But on the voter, the people who said they intended to vote, Gohmert scored substantially higher than George P. Bush did, up to about 13 points. And Bush was in Bush and Guzman, Eva Guzman, were in single digits. And what that suggests to me is that Paxton has spent the last 5 years running away from cameras, and cameras tend to run toward Gohmert. And the name, there may be a resurgence of establishment Republicans in Texas. But no matter how many times George P. Bush says the name Donald Trump, he's still going to be associated with establishment Republicans. And the fact that Paxton is doing his basic political advertising attacking Gohmert suggests that their polling shows more vulnerability to Gohmert. And I have to simply say that as purely for entertainment value, Paxton has been unsurpassed, except maybe by Sid Miller, who's agriculture commissioner, on a couple of occasions. But having Louis Gohmert speaking for the legal system of the state of Texas would be a journalist's delight.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had Gromer Jeffers on the podcast last week, and we talked a lot about this race. I mean, the dynamics here are very interesting. I mean, I think. I can't remember who it was. Somebody wrote recently about the movement of the conventional wisdom in this race from, you know, Paxton is sure to be in a runoff to, I think very briefly, like, well, maybe not to, yeah, he's going to be in a runoff. I think trying to, you know, unpack the Gohmert, you know, the challenges to Paxton here and who, you know, where people have momentum and where the, you know, they have the potential to tap into Republican primary voters is one of the really interesting issues here, as you were saying. I mean, you know, as I was doing a little bit of taking a look at this and thinking about the podcast that I had done with in the conversation I had with Gromer last week, you know, I went and looked at the Google Trends search, you know, data, and I don't know if you ever do that, but it gives you this kind of relative look, and you know, you can isolate it to Texas for what terms people are searching. And I was thinking about this idea of a Gohmert surge and how big it was, you know, and thought about the degree to which Gohmert gets a lot of attention. And even though he's in some ways, you know, from the Texas and the representative perspective, he's a regional person. On the other hand, you know, he is a regular on very conservative / right-wing media, talk radio, cable, et cetera, and that he might have some hidden recognition out there. But I'll tell you, when I looked at that Google trend data, you know, in the last week, 10 days, there's something going on with George P. Bush in which there's a bunch of search activity, you know, big spikes in that data. And I don't, you know, I look at that data, I never know what to make of it. It's not polling. It's a strange, you know, bank shot into what is going on. But it does seem that something was going on with George P. You know, it may have just been that they were spending, you know, money in targeted ways and were getting some payback on that I was a little surprised by.
The first level of response is Paxton, I don't think, is going to be short of money to counterattack. If they decide Gohmert's not their primary challenge, the tell is going to be that they start focusing their guns on Bush. And Bush has had a troubled career in politics, whether it's the Alamo or the failure to distribute money to the victims of Hurricane Harvey, catchy name there. Despite the fact that Paxton deeply flawed indicted, those are no longer disqualifications in the Republican primary. But the Alamo may in fact Trump, pardon the pun, Trump everything else. But I do. It looks more and more certain to me that that Paxton will be in a runoff, and if he is in a runoff, it strikes me that the old more people will have voted against him in the first election, and they're likely to come back. And I think we're going to have outside money, whether if Eva Guzman crashes and burns, TLR is now committed against Paxton, and in for a dime, in for a dollar, and we'll see expenditures, whether identified as TLR or other groups, Texans for Lawsuit Reform, for those who don't know.
Right.
I think we'll see. The legal community is appalled with Paxton, and it would not surprise me to see third-party money surfacing at the very beginning of early voting to do their best to undermine Paxton.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was probably, thinking very much, along the lines that you were to a certain degree, or that you kind of suggested half jokingly earlier, or, lightheartedly, I should say, that, the idea of a Paxton-Gohmert runoff really is kind of amazing in a lot of different ways. The more I thought about it and looked at this looked at the polling that we saw come out over the weekend, frankly, probably affected more than I should be by that Google data, is that the Paxton focus on Gohmert, which was focused also, interestingly, not only on him, but in his region, may well have been a tactic meant not to keep him out of second place, but to drive his numbers down in terms of the dynamic of trying to, on the assumption that if people are not going to vote for Gohmert, or they're interested in Gohmert, but you're trying to move them off of him, they're much more likely to move back to Paxton than they are to either Bush or Guzman. But, we'll find out once once people start voting.
Well, let me turn the tables on you for just a moment. And you guys are constantly in the field and measuring sentiment. Do you have the sense this is going to be a high turnout primary or a low turnout primary?
I don't know yet. We don't have fresh data quite yet. Mm-hmm. I do not think this is going to be an unusually high level turnout. That's my sense of it. Particularly, our most recent comparative baseline is really high. If you're going to compare it to the last midterm in 2018, I don't think we're going to be north of that. And if it is, it's not going to be much.
Well, it is a midterm after all. And typically, historically, what happens is the most inflamed are the ones that turn out in the highest numbers in a midterm.
When we look at our who we think is going to turn out, or we're I'm sort of licking my thumb and testing the wind, but using the data on this, we look at our breakdowns of conservative, the intensity of conservative identification, intensity of Republican identification, to start thinking about. We use that a lot in terms of thinking about issue position. So, yeah, and I think that's right. The committed turnout for midterm primaries, unless there's something really unusual going on, and I don't think that there's anything driving that at this point, even though, it's a very noisy environment, whether that gets vectored into primary elections or not. I don't see any indications that we're seeing a big surge. I didn't see any of that. I was kind of looking at that in some of the hobby and the DMN data while, we're still working on our own fresh stuff. I don't see any signs of a big surge in interest in the primaries. Now, that's not to say there aren't some interesting things going on. And before we move on from the races, you mentioned again in semi-lighthearted mansion, Sid Miller. What do you think of the Miller-White primary race on the Republican side for AG? For Ag Commissioner.
Well, frankly, of course, the momentum and the wind is at Sid Miller's back. He is proven to be a master of social media. However, his fundamental problem, which again is not right now, there's so many indictments inside the Republican universe, the National Republican universe, and the Texas Republican universe, that it may have no effect at all. But the fact that his political consultant and longtime friend Todd Smith is under indictment and will be in court within days before the primary is may have some impact.
Not helpful, shall we say?
Yes, I think it's going to be hard for Sid Miller to control the narrative when this guy is defending himself for allegedly taking, if I remember correctly, $50,000 chunks in order to expedite hemp growing licenses.
Right, and that's part of the problem. I mean, that indictment is you know, he's not being the indictment is not about matters, you know, related simply to his to a consulting business or something else. It's pretty directly tied to the Ag Commissioner and the, or at least the Ag Commissioner's office.
Institutionally, I don't think he's got very much support behind him. James White has really, of course, it's a perfect name. He's an African American in a Republican primary, which is not, but he's been elected in a very heavy Republican East Texas district at the State House for over a decade. But African Americans obviously do have some additional difficulty in Republican primaries. But he has been remarkably aggressive and about the corruption at the or the alleged corruption at the Department of Agriculture, and he's broken through not into mainstream media, but he's pretty much all over social media, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or whatever, and I tend to. Again, don't have any empirical evidence, but I think that those actually are more important to as news sources, more important to Republican primary voters than NBC, CBS, or even.
We know that that targeted media does, in fact, you know, that particularly, you know, it's across the spectrum, but it's particularly important on the conservative end of the spectrum. And I think, you know, another thing we can say about James White is that, you know, should he get voters' attention, he has a pretty good record for a Republican primary election, given, for example, his vocal leadership on Second Amendment rights, constitutional carry, et cetera. So, you know, if he can get people's attention, he's got messaging for them.
And I may be suffering senior brain porosity, but I do recall that he was a chairman of corrections in the Texas House, rose to a leadership position, and has matured. Not that maturing as a legislator counts for very much in a primary, but he has a pretty darn good resume.
Right.
And, as far as show business goes, nobody is better at it than Sid Miller.
But they are an interesting pair.
Yes,
The guy, you know, I moderated a panel with that Representative White will participated in, and I will say this. In terms of his ability to, you know, spin up rhetoric that is going to be very attractive to voters on the far right, he is competitive in that dimension with the Ag Commissioner, and I'll leave it at that. People can find that panel if they want to track it down. Before we move on, you know, you mentioned Texans for lawsuit reform, and there's opposition to Attorney General Paxton. They also endorse James White. You know, what is going on with that? Well, you know, what is driving these endorsements for Texans for lawsuit reform in your view? And I should have mentioned, you know, this is really, you know, an area in which you really live. You followed this issue and a lot of the players here for a long time. So I'm very interested in your read of this.
Actually, my first breakout story 30 some odd years ago was, critical piece on the trial lawyers, which I apparently it was a breakthrough because nobody had ever been critical of the plaintiff's bar previously. But what Texans for Lawsuit Reform, with one exception, suggests that it's the reassertion of establishment politics. I know that the legal Republican legal community in Houston and Dallas, which are, of course, a big source of their funding, are upset with what they see as a surplus of embarrassments among some of our office holders. And they have put a marker down. Now, they're not going to be in very much danger because they're one of the two or three biggest PACs in the state. And while their success record is spotty, it is they're not to be trifled with. But when I say that it's the reassertion of the Republican establishment, I have to back off to a certain degree because they have been very, very vocal and very active in decrying the attack on critical race theory, whether it exists or not in Texas public schools. But I know that their leadership is, while leans towards establishment Republicanism, has been highly motivated on that issue. So it's kind of a mixed bag.
Well, I mean, I think what it, you know, as I watch these endorsements unfold and some of what we think of is, yeah, the rock-ribbed Republican interest groups, you know, at the state level manage the shifts in the Republican Party. It all seems to me to play into a kind of fragmentation and a kind of realignment between what we have traditionally thought of as, you know, the business slash party establishment and you know, the emergence of both voter sentiment groups, I should say all three voter sentiment, or more organized groups and opinion leaders, you know, that call themselves roughly right now the conservative grassroots, and an increasing lack of alignment between those two general domains in the Republican Party. And that's why I think, you know, TLR's decide to work against Paxton, I think is very, very interesting and a very kind of telling indicator of just how difficult that's becoming inside the Republican Party. It's been kind of an underlying theme. You kind of started there when we talked about Abbott.
And I should add that I'll give it away. I've been doing this since 1989 and I've never seen such an anti big business group of Republicans. Republican populism is obviously found a voice with former President Trump. But you sit there in committee hearings or you watch committee hearings during the legislative session, and both law enforcement and business will take positions and then get routinely ignored, particularly in the Texas Senate, which is something entirely new. Small parochial battles obviously get played out, but I think that the subtext of the TLR opposition to Paxton is also partially, hey guys, you got to take us seriously over here. Business, tort reform is always going to pass, but all the other issues related to business, and they're kind of an unofficial Texas Chamber of Commerce in a lot of ways. It's an assertion they're a force to be reckoned with on matters other than just tort.
So we're going to come to a close pretty quick. We tend to be most, I think, aware of these kinds of intra-party fractures, and particularly in the Republican Party, because they are, you know, the de facto party of the state in Texas, party of government in Texas. How much is this going to matter in 4 or 5 months as we get close to the general election?
I do believe that there is going to be a quantifiable number of Republicans that can't vote for Beto, but may actually skip the governor's race. At least anecdotally, I'm hearing it too frequently to think that it's just the Capitol echo chamber. But unless a certain sitting president finds his mojo, he's a 10-point anchor on around the neck of pretty much any Democrat that might have some viability. We don't know yet who's going to be running against Lieutenant Governor Patrick, but we saw his vulnerability last time. And that was a result of the bathroom bill to a large degree and culture wars. And the Republican Party in this last session has been all about culture wars. And so, they're facing an undisciplined candidate at the top of the ticket in Beto O'Rourke. He's better than he was, but he is still undisciplined, I guess is the best way to put it. And, one of my mentors, Paul Burka, the a former senior editor, political editor of Texas Monthly, used to say, anybody that's out looking for new voters, I have a term for it. It's called loser.
Yeah.
And that's a big portion of the O'Rourke campaign. However, he will have more than enough money to be competitive. And as the center of gravity continues to grow along, voter center of gravity continues to grow along the urban suburban areas on the I-35 corridor in Houston. I think that there's more life to the Democrats than we would ordinarily think, but with Joe Biden in the 30s, it's an impossible hurdle to overcome.
Yeah, I mean, I think you emphasizing the Biden factor underlines something that I might, that I might have sort of raised in as something to consider alongside Patrick's emphasis on the culture wars and the things that made the election close in 2018. You know, you used the wind metaphor earlier. I mean, I think the Democrats had the wind at their back in 2018, in 2022, the wind is blowing at gale force in their face, at least as of now. And I think that is a big factor in terms of who has comparative advantage in shaping the agenda going into the election and whose mobilization efforts are probably more likely to succeed. But I think we'll put a pin in that. If you'll come back after the primaries and as we get closer to the general election, we'll dig down into that more. How's that for? Is that a deal?
I'm shaking your hand through the internet.
Excellent, brother. Harvey Kronberg, thanks for being here. Much appreciated.
My pleasure. It's always fun, Jim.
I also want to thank our excellent crew in the studio here in the Liberal Arts Development Studio at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks to you for listening. Some of the data we talked about and much more at our website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. So thanks again for listening, and we'll be back next week. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.